First up, we're going to hear from Jim Rettberg from New York State Electricity and Gas, and he's going to talk about a couple of preliminary case projects that they're taking a look at right now. Jim?
Thanks, Jim. As soon as we get the slide package up. There we go. My name is Jim Rettberg, and I'm the project manager for NYSEG's K's demonstration project. And I'd like to give you an overview of what we're what we've been up to for about the last year. A couple of acknowledgments. First, certainly to thank the DOE and our friends at Nettle for their support. Also, I'd like to acknowledge NYSERDA's financial support, along with that of NYSEG and Iberdrola USA, for allowing us to proceed with phase one of this project. In addition, our supporting cast of technical experts we've listed down at the bottom. And on that note, too, I'd like to add a thanks to both Energy Storage and Power, Man Diesel Turbo, and to Dresser Rand. We've evaluated, as you'll see in a few minutes, both cycles, developed front-end engineering designs on both cycles, and the vendors have been very, very supportive and very helpful. So thanks to them for sure. Okay, a little bit of background real quick for those of you who may not be familiar with this. I'm not going to read all these bullets, but we are located in upstate New York. We're part of Iberdrola USA. We have a sister company, Rochester Gas and Electric, but these stats here are for NYSEG alone. Phase one of the project, and the project is really divided into three phases, but phase one is where we are now. The project started earlier this year. It's budgeted for about $4.5 million, equally co-funded between the DOE and NYSEG/Iberdrola's shareholders, not customers. The good news is that we are on track for completing phase one front-end engineering design and evaluations by the end of this year. Unfortunately, the bad news is we're about 3 weeks away from having a lot of the financials and the dollar estimates and things that would be, I think, of most interest to folks. But if this conference had been a month later, we'd have a little different and a little more detailed presentation. But be that as it may, I wanted to give you an update of where we are and what we found so far. And I think the important thing here is that our management is going to have to make a go, no-go decision on whether to proceed to phase two development of this project by the end of the year or early next. So they give you a quick overview. This is a slide that Bob Shanker prepared, and I shamelessly stole. I think you've all seen similar versions of this earlier today, so I'm not going to get into it. It's just a good high-level illustration of what K's is all about. There we go. The project is on a site located on the western side of Seneca Lake, in New York Finger Lakes region, about 3 miles north of Watkins Glen. The area has been extensively salt mined for over 100 years, and it continues. The solution mining continues. We originally planned to use a site on the eastern side of Route 14, closer to the lake, but Energy, the site owner, proposed to develop a new cavern for use in the K's project. And that's highlighted in yellow here. And actually, this new site is a lot better location from a number of perspectives, including the fact that it's well screened by trees. It's the lake from Route 14 to the lake slopes off and drops about 600 feet. But up in where we are, it's pretty flat, screened by trees. It's got a very low viewshed profile from Seneca Lake and the boating community and the recreational activities on the other side of the lake. So. We think it's a pretty good spot. We'll talk a little bit more. This is probably the most important part for anybody who is entertaining any kind of energy storage, but particularly for a K's project, is to really define what you want the project and the equipment to do, because that'll drive everything else. As you can see from this slide, we anticipate that the project would operate in a daily cycling mode on a weekday basis. So what you're looking at there is 260 to 300 starts per year. And some days you may see double starts, morning and evening peak type load service. In our case, we also need, because of that and because of the size constraints on the cavern, we need to have a large compression train to be able to capture opportunities where windows of low-cost power are available, and also to be able to recharge on a nightly basis so that we can operate during the next day. And as slide notes, we've looked at two K's cycles, cycle one by Dresser Rand and cycle two by Energy Storage and Power and Man Diesel. And we'll talk a little bit about those two next. I just wanted to highlight the cycle diagrams. No one should get too carried away with the numbers here. These are still a work in progress. And in fact, this one is the K's1 cycle. We're working closely with Dresser Rand, and there could be some significant changes coming in the next to the slide in the next couple of weeks, particularly on the generation train. I think we're going to have a larger machine. But basically, what you see, and some of this Dr. Nikampkin illustrated this morning in his talk, a couple of very large compressors, and in this case, a high and a low pressure expander, which are basically connected to a single generator. And this is somewhat similar to, conceptually similar to the Alabama plant, but really, practically speaking, very different. A lot of enhancements. And specifically designed to operate in a modern wholesale market environment. And the energy ratio, net output, and heat rates, you know, are at full load. They'll obviously vary across the load range. And the heating value we illustrate is using higher heating value, not lower heating value. Some people do the other way, but we look at things in terms of higher heating value. This is Dr. Mike's cycle that he talked about this morning. Here we're using a couple of 185 megawatt air compressors. We have about 170 megawatts net import capability for the compression side. And at the site, we have about 210 megawatts of takeaway capability. We would be interconnecting to two of NYSEG's 115 kV circuits in the area. And so because of that, we are somewhat constrained on the electrical side of things, but this is again just an illustration, and we're still working through this information. Okay, I wanted to just give you a quick highlight of the folks that are helping us out. Again, I won't read all this, but we've retained a very capable a team of support team. I think we've all learned a lot here, but they've made my life a whole lot easier. Thanks to their expertise and their willingness to be very flexible in design and quick reactions to the changes as we kind of work our way through. These are definitely new technologies in terms of architect engineering, and it's been a learning experience for all of us. Okay. The cavern design, we've had Parsons Brinker off Energy Storage Systems, PBESS, help us. We could go on for probably an hour on this one, but originally we were looking at a pressure range of between 1,500 and down to 750 pounds in about a 5 million cubic foot free void space cavern. And we thought we were in pretty good shape, but PB, based on the design basis, the number of cycles per day, the air withdrawal rates, and plugging that into into their modeling, their geomechanical and the thermodynamic modeling indicated some fairly significant problems with using a single cavern. The long and the short of it is that as the slide notes, when we would operate in the cycling mode that we think we would like to operate in, you could see significant damage to the salt on the cavern ceiling and the walls due to withdrawing air so quickly that the temperature drops so fast that the salt goes into tension and starts to spall off the walls. Salt's real good in compression, but like a lot of other materials, including concrete, it's not good in tension. And it turned out to be a real problem. The solution is basically that we would need to develop three caverns, each one about 5 million cubic foot size, in order to sustain the operation that we want. What that means is that we need to, and because it takes a couple of years to develop each cavern, it means that the project will probably start up with one, possibly two caverns in service. It doesn't limit the output of the capability, but it does limit the duration of operation. And then it will be a couple of years at least after the commercial operation before all three caverns are in service. Okay. I think a couple of key takeaways here. Worley's spent almost 20,000 engineering man hours in developing the front-end engineering design for both of these case cycles. Very extensive body of work, which we'll be providing to the DOE and to the general public as part of our Phase 1 report. I think another takeaway, too, is that based on the design basis that we have laid out here and the equipment sizes and the configurations that we've got, there's no way that this thing is going to come in either of these cycles for less than $300 million in our view. Now, we still are working through the numbers. It'll be another couple of weeks before we, have this down to a point where we have a little more confidence in it. But just on an overnight cost basis, it's definitely north of $300 million, and I don't see it coming under. Doesn't mean it's not going to go forward, but it means there's a lot tougher sell. Talk real quick about the dispatch modeling work that Customized Energy Solutions is doing for us. Kind of the key takeaway here is this is not maybe your old-fashioned dispatch model you would use to evaluate the economics of a natural gas combined cycle. You have to take into account the air storage inventory, its value, and use that in the basis to decide whether or not you're going to charge or run and when. The dispatch model is an hourly model. It's not a typical week model or by season. It's hourly. And it has to take into account the air inventory levels. And it looks forward on a 3 to 5 day basis and it actually develops a dispatch and charging energy plan that it uses in the simulation. So it's new, it's different, but I think it'll be able to capture, and it also will model not just energy arbitrage, but regulation service and synchronous reserve revenues and combine all three products. And it's based on New York ISO day-ahead market dynamics. We're using several forward price curves. These are just a quick illustration. They're all based on studies or data sets that were developed by the New York ISO in various studies. That's where a lot of these strange-looking acronyms come from, in parentheses here. But I think by doing this, we'll have a pretty good bandwidth of possible and potential outcomes for sensitivity case testing. We'll probably also do some stochastic modeling, too. But I think we certainly ought to have it bracketed. Okay. Now, we're modeling this as a rate-based model. And on that basis, we're looking at how this plays out against our regulated delivery customers in terms of the value proposition for those folks. And basically that bullet that says fixed cost recovery is really the key. They flow through the fixed cost and revenue requirements, all flow through to retail customers on a volumetric delivery charge basis, but would then be offset by monthly net revenues that flow through, would also flow through to the delivery customers. And I tried to illustrate that on the next slide. This is not based on any modeling. It's more just as an illustration, with the orange bars being the total fixed cost recovery burden on an annual basis in this case. And ideally, you'd like to see that blue line, which is the total net revenue line, cross at some point. Remains to be seen whether that'll happen or not. But I thought this was a quick and easy way to understand the financial model and what we're hoping to achieve. These are the next steps, which basically is pretty much finish what we've been doing, button it up into a a final report and recommendation for our management, and then compile all of the detailed engineering work and produce a report that will go to the DOE and I think be available publicly, at least in general terms, for folks to use in terms of lessons. And quickly at the end, about 3 seconds left, there's some key points from lesson one. Number one, do your homework. You really have to develop a design basis and understand the site conditions. Don't use generic dollars per kW because they really are just that, generic. You know, they may apply, they may not to your specific application. And get the best technical expertise that you can get and do your homework. Okay. Thank you.
Next up we have Kent Holst, who's, I know, been pushing this big rock up a steep hill for a few years now, and he's going to be joined by Mike King to talk a little bit about some of the other details on the Iowa Stored Energy Park. That's how you
proceed to the green arrow. Okay. Thank you, Jim, and thank you to all of you in the audience. Pleasure to be here. Not necessarily a pleasure of the message that I have to give you. This is titled Start to Stop, and before I get any further into the presentation, I do want to make note of the special thanks for George Ann Huff from Sandia and Dr. Zhuk from DOE, who have been very instrumental as we've gone through the years on this project. A Start to Stop message tells the story almost right there in those three words. We are shutting down the project. We'll get into the reason in a moment as to why that is. We found a reason why it was not prudent to continue with the project, and we'll explain the details of that in a little bit. But we don't consider the project to have been a failure. We have learned an awful lot, many, many lessons, and we want to share these lessons with others. We don't want everyone to have to expend the time and dollars that we have to get to where we're at. You just as well be able to take advantage of our experience, and I'll explain how we're going to make that available in a little bit here. So the purpose of this presentation is to show you the path that we have followed as we learned about the details of large-scale energy storage, and then to show you how we plan to share these results. In the beginning, what did we need to learn, and what have we learned in these 10 years? The first thing we had to learn is, what is compressed air energy storage? 10 years ago, even though there's a couple of plants been operating in the world for quite a while, we didn't know, and an awful lot of people that had very little idea of what CASE stood for, and obviously now most everybody does. The second thing is what is needed for a successful CASE operation. The last presentation, Jim, gave a lot of good details on that. But for us, the way we got started, we looked at four things that we felt we really needed to learn about. The first was where to get financial support. We were a group of municipal utilities in Iowa that had this idea to build a CASE plant, and we needed financial support just to get the initial work done, and eventually we knew we would need dollars for the construction, the geology. As I said, we were a bunch of municipal utilities. None of us had any background in geology. We needed to learn a lot there, and Mike King, who's going to be up here in a moment, will explain a lot of that. Economic feasibility, there's been a lot of presentations on various ways of looking at this. Obviously, any project like this in the end has to be able to show that it will pay for itself. CASE is a great sounding idea, but in the end, you got to make money. And how do you get the neighbors? We're talking very close into a small town in Iowa, so public support for our project was a key element that we had to work on right from the very beginning. But going back to the financial support, we got some initial seed money from our municipal utilities. The Iowa Congressional delegation made sure that there was some money in the federal budget that the DOE could work with us on. The Iowa Power Fund was a fund that was set up by actually our past governor, not the present one, and set up to finance innovative ways to try to make Iowa more energy independent. They were very supportive. And then through joint action agencies, we gained some membership from municipal utilities in surrounding states. The whole goal here in this beginning stages was to provide proof to investors that what we were proposing to do was financially feasible and would make them money in the end. Over the past 10 years, we have invested approximately $9 million in this project. It was used in a variety of ways, and I'll get into those in a second, but we had to have proof positive for the later investors. Our municipal utilities that we started with knew that they would never be able to finance this entire project. So besides going through all of the due diligence for everything else, we had to make sure we had a solid story to look for future investors. And we had no specific target, whether it would be investor-owned utilities or venture capitalists or how this was going to come about, but we knew that we had to have a lot of solid data and documentation of it. We have produced a lot of that, and that's what we intend to share with everybody that might want to take a look at it. The local involvement side of things was interesting. I had meetings with the local city council, Rotary Club, invited the general public into meetings, anybody that would come, supervisor, county supervisors. We put out a lot of publicity on everything, and we quickly realized that we really need to address the particular concerns of the people in the area. We hired a firm called Magid and Associates, Frank Magid and Associates, that did a blind telephone survey of residents in the county and produced a very solid set of data of what the hot topics were and what they were interested in. And obviously, we focused all of our presentations on that kind of information. Again, this Magid report will be available to everyone. Economic feasibility, as everybody says, has to be an important part of this. We had several firms help us as we went through this. One of the first reports that we had produced in 2003 was by Burns and McDonald. It's kind of interesting that between this report in 2003 and another we had done in 2008, the estimated cost of our project went from $200 million to $400 million. We'll never know. We had an economic feasibility analysis, the title of a report by Black & Veatch. That was done in 2005. It produced results that showed that under a number of operating scenarios that we could still make money. We were encouraged again as we went along. And then finally, in 2010, a report called Cost Estimate and Economic Study was done by R.W. Beck. There was two phases to it. And the phase two report, the phase one was a basic economic feasibility study. This phase two, which was just recently completed, showed the impact of heavy wind integration and that we are experiencing in Iowa, and the impact that large-scale storage could have on enhancing that the value of those wind resources. All of these reports will soon be posted on our website, which is shown on the screen there, wwisepa.com. 30 to 45 days from now, we should have all of these reports available to everybody. That's why I'm not trying to spend much time on any one of them. The details will be available to you. But to give you an idea, the R.W. Beck report by in our phase one, you can read the things that they worked on. It was very, very comprehensive, the most comprehensive report we have had done to point. It was very interesting throughout these studies that we found two things that we really were lacking, and that is a really good understanding of storage in resource planning models. There was a lot of work trying to improve the models as we went along. I think a lot of them still do. Another area that has been shown, tariffs do not, present-day tariffs do not adequately show the revenue streams that are necessary to make these things really work good. The geologic studies, we had a lot of help. The Iowa Geological and Water Survey in Iowa had a lot of records. Bay Geophysical did seismic surveys and electricity and air storage enterprises. Our main geologist is the hydraulics group from Seattle. Mike King now is going to show you some of the results of that work.
Next slide.
We've got about 3 minutes.
Okay, we'll go quick. Okay. I'm the reason the project quit, just to let you know right up front. Okay. And we keep saying, and I keep preaching this, aquifers are problematic, and the biggest problem is we have no data, and by the time you drill a lot of geophysics and spend a lot of money on wells, just to find out the thing doesn't work. Okay, so from a design standpoint, it's pretty simple. The reservoir needs to deliver enough air at a high enough pressure and flow rate to run your turbine. It's real simple. So we got to find a geological structure that can support 400 pounds per second. If you use the Dresser-Rand design on 135 megawatts at about 820 PSI. Okay, so that was kind of our criteria when we went through. We had four phases to it. Basically, the first one had to find a site, and we looked at about 20 reservoirs and found that the natural gas industry picked all the good sites. Classic. But we finally found one, and in doing so, then we did phase two, which is the characterization of the site, and that involved 10 miles of geophysical surveys, exploration wells, drilling, core analysis with Sandia, and then numerical reservoir simulation modeling. And it was at that point, every time we went through a particular phase, it was a no-go decision made in each one of them. The next phase would have been field testing, and then ultimately commercial design, which we never got to. Okay, next slide. It's real simple. We had about a square mile geological structure in the Mount Simon sandstone. It's the deepest sandstone within Iowa formation, about 3,000 feet deep. When we started out the study, we only had this well and no other data. We then did all these geophysical survey lines across the structure, and that defined the boundaries of the structure. We started drilling wells. Every time we drilled a new well into the Mount Simon, our little picture of this structure started changing. So it wasn't a nice, pretty little dome. It was actually two little domes within the larger structure. Next slide. Okay, so when we look at the Dallas Center structure, had a pretty good cap rock on it. We had a second dome here, but we only had 65 feet of closure. That's the point where the air, if you fill it up, it's going to leak out. Okay, the other thing we found is that the permeability within this rock wasn't what we expected. We have a gas field 6 miles away, 150-foot thick sandstone, gorgeous structure, and great permeability. And here we are at Dallas Center, and we just don't have it. Next slide. Okay, so this is real important. Here's a geological profile through the reservoir, and we did a reservoir simulation using the TUF2 modeling code, and we tried analyzing it from putting vertical wells in. We put in one large horizontal well, through the system, and then we tried several small horizontal wells through the system to see if we could get an air bubble created. The problem was within this formation, there was 57 different shale layers and sand layers within that system. So what does that mean? Well, it means that we couldn't get a bubble created because the air preferred to go in the horizontal direction instead of the vertical direction. So when we created the bubble, and this is the one for the horizontal well system, within a few days, several days here, all of a sudden we started seeing a pressure decline within the reservoir over a very short time. So about basically that air was leaking out in the horizontal direction, and we hadn't created the adequate air bubble we needed to make it work. Could not support the system. We're over at the Redfield site, when we simulated that for compressed air, instead of having half a millidarcy or less permeability in these lenses, we had several darcies of permeability. So that was our thing. Thanks.
Okay. Just to wrap up, here's a list of all of the areas that we studied during this thing. And information on all of these will be on our website very soon. So thank you for your listening today.
Thank you. Okay, finally, we got a gentleman who's trying to deal with the geologic problems by not dealing with the geologic problems. He's got an above-ground modular case plant that he's going to tell you about. This is Professor Joe Simmons from University of Arizona.
Thank you, Jim, and thanks for all of you to stay here this late in the day on the last day. Our project, both the group I represent is the Arizona Solar Energy Research Institute at University of Arizona, and my two co-authors are here in the audience as well as one of the students. We had 8 students in this project. The project started many years ago, and what AZRISE does is we looked at measuring performance of solar photovoltaics and predicting performance of solar photovoltaics, and very quickly we got into the question of what to do about energy storage. So if I can, I guess I move them. Huh? Yeah, move. So this is the type of performance data that we obtained for fixed flat plate PV, and you can see that there are some very good days at the bottom line, very bad days in the top line, and in the very bad days you see that there is intermittency, which is very short, as well as not much energy generated on some of the days. So we found that we decided that, you know, you've seen all this. We need to do intermittency in order to maintain local grid stability, then a time shifting, seasonal arbitrage. I'll show you that too. And eventually one of the niches we looked at is possibly distributed energy delivery. So the reason that you do time shifting is that if you have a photovoltaic system, which is a single axis tracking, which is more attractive and more useful compared to a load curve for the Tucson area, and you can see that there you produce with single axis tracking, you produce a lot of energy in the morning, and you don't have enough in the afternoon. So you need to do time shifting, and so this load mismatch gives you a good reason to do energy storage. And then of course, seasonal. This is again Tucson area. The demand load is the red curve, and you can see that if you add all of the production power that you can get, energy that you do from PV, you can see the blue curve, and you can see that spring's a great time to have PV, but fall and summer are not. And so, again, seasonal arbitrage would have value. So we decided to start looking at the value of doing case in these cases, in these situations. And the first thing we looked at was whether case can be used to balance the grid, do peak shaving, then what value it would have in daily arbitrage. And I'm going to give you some examples of that. What I will show you is that the economic gain in all of these situations is associated with a reduction in the natural gas consumption during case operation, during the expansion stage. And so this is the first example. We did this about 3 years ago. To determine the kind of capacities that one needed in order to do time shifting. So this is a curve that has a constant grid level, And you see the demand curve. This is a demand curve for the Phoenix area in Arizona. And so we picked a fixed grid level, and then just using case, could we pump in to case during the part where the grid's higher than the demand? And then the answer is, of course, yes. But the nice thing is that it gave us the size storage system that we would need. And this is all summarized in the box below. I'm going to go through these very quickly, and I apologize. If you have questions, I'll be happy to talk to you about them later. So we used a system optimizer, which was developed by Young Jun Sun, who's in the audience here, one of my co-authors. And we looked at if you did arbitrage, but when electricity avoided cost was low, and when avoided cost was high, you would sell. And so just doing that very simple model, what would you do? Would you make money or lose money on a very hot day in the summer when the demand is very high for air conditioning? So if the difference between the maximum and the minimum in the avoided cost was 6 cents per kilowatt hour, you would lose money, and the number is in parentheses. If you had to use 4,300 BTUs per kilowatt hour of natural gas. However, if you could reduce that consumption down to 60%, you would start making money. And at half the consumption of the natural gas, you would make money. And you can see that as the difference between the maximum and minimum increased a little bit, then you get into the green area, and at 6.6 cents a kilowatt hour, you're making money at all in all cases. So this encouraged us to try to see if we could build a case system that was fully optimized in every single step. So the technology is essentially compression, storage, expansion, and the idea is, since you create so much heat during the compression stage, you better do thermal management. And the economics basically are driven by the fact that you really need to eliminate natural gas. And so if you keep that in mind, then obviously you have to do thermal management. The other thing that we looked at is we wanted to do a small-scale design for two reasons. One is that large-scale designs are expensive, as you've heard. And the second reason really is that you can have scalability of costs. So if you design a small unit, you can look to components that can be scaled up very easily, whereas if you look at large systems, it's very difficult to scale down the turbine, for example. So that's the goal of our project, to basically build something that at about 10 kilowatts that would be optimized to 10 that could be scaled up to 10 megawatts, and then optimize every single step of the process. This is a design of our system. We have a compressor, a multi-stage compressor, take the heat out at every stage, store the heat, re-inject it into the air before it goes into the expander systems. We design, in fact, three different expanding machineries. I'll talk about some of them, and store everything in the above ground tank to get about 3 hours of operation. So Bauer three-stage compressor was a fabulous compressor. We looked at it. Has very high efficiency. Has intercoolers. And you can see in the split view, it has three pistons. And so we're designing a system where we're removing the intercoolers and putting heat exchange, thermal exchange systems to take the heat out. By taking the heat out at every stage, you're actually making a much more efficient system in the compression. And so you're losing what you're trying to get, which is the heat. But on the other hand, it's always a better idea to have a more efficient system and only take the residual heat. So if you look at this graph here, the part in blue is the difference between using a three-stage system and only a single-stage system. So that blue dashed area is given up by doing heat exchange at every stage. Let's see. The other thing we did was we looked at, for designing above-ground tanks, what is the optimum value that you can get from a tank as far as maximum pressure. As you increase the pressure, the tank, the wall materials have to be thicker, and so this is a study of pressure versus maximum pressure versus the volume in the tank, and the cost is actually drawn on the lines. And so we found that a very nice sweet spot at around 500 PSI. So this is where we're working. We picked 500 PSI. The expansion stage is really the most difficult, and that's what really determines success and failure in case systems. And we designed a pneumatic expansion engine with injection of stored heat ahead of time before the air is injected into the system. And we also have a combination combustion piston engine, which is not really my favorite one, but, you know, that's a fallback system that's very similar to a typical combustion engine, internal combustion engine. And then a multi-stage tandem turbines, which is made by a company that we're working with, partnering on this project. Our goal is to look at the response characteristics and then the heat transfer effects and then examine the efficiency in order to determine cost. This is what the turbine looks like. It's got a multi-hole turbine, and it's made by a company called W2 Energy. And essentially you inject the air, you can heat up the air, you can combust the air also if you wish. And the idea is to work at about 2 to 10 kilowatts, in fact, in the system. This is a piston engine with supersonic pneumatic accelerator that we've developed at the university. Actually, an undergraduate student is working on this and has designed it, and it's performing beautifully. So this is one of the great results, I think, that'll come out of his study. We're putting all of these parts together. The compressor is operating. The air storage tank is in place. And with the expansion stages will be together in the next few months. What we're doing is partnering with utility, the local utility, Tucson Electric Power, and we've also worked with Arizona Public Service. And they've been very good at coming to us to ask us to show them what kind of technologies can be used for energy storage. Both utilities in Arizona understand the value of energy storage. And so what we've done is set up a system, a test facility at Tucson Electric Utility at one of their sites in order to test various energy storage systems. And this is a list of where this unit will be put, our case system will be put. It has four different kinds of technologies generating electricity from PV power. Two of them are concentrated and two of them are flat plate. And the energy storage will involve some lithium-ion batteries, some supercapacitors, and then our case system with thermal management. The idea is to mix these different technologies to see how well you respond to very fast changes in power from the from both the flat plate and the concentrated PV, and how one might mix batteries with compressed air. And then as a load, we have an R&D laboratory that this is feeding power to, and also we're planning to put electric recharge stations right on site in order to test that as well. Our partners, we've been supported by DOE, NETL, and also Science Foundation Arizona, which is a state of Arizona operation, by Tucson Electric Power, Solon America, and we have some battery companies that are asking to be our partners as well. So, and this is the end of my talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joe. Next up, we're going to take some questions. We've got about 10 minutes for questions. Any questions?
Testing. Oh, there it is. For the group from the Iowa Stored Energy Project, did you guys get into discussions with FERC and any of the commissioners there about your project? And specifically, I'm asking about Commissioner Norris, who's from Iowa, if he kind of came out in support of the project or not.
When he was with the Iowa Utilities Board, he definitely expressed support. We have dealt and continue to deal mostly with MISO to try to get adjustments to their tariffs so that the benefits of large-scale storage can have a revenue stream.
Any other questions?
Bob Blackstock with the Sun Edison. Mostly this is a question to Mike King, and that was about the natural gas storage facilities that are also in that same area of Iowa. You said that the gas companies had taken the best sites, but could you expand on those comments as to why it is that it seems like those gas storage facilities seem to be better suited to their storage as opposed to perhaps the compressed air storage?
Sure. We looked at working with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We identified practically most of the geological aquifer dome structures in Iowa, and there was about 20 of them. Okay, so starting in the 70s, gas storage is in real demand. So they went out, and the gas companies had a lot of money and drilled, for example, the structure up north? Right. Right. So they drilled 18 wells. Okay, well, we only had money to drill three. And then after drilling 18 wells, they've had a structure, and they put in 2 billion cubic feet of natural gas, and it disappeared. Okay, so they had a long track record to track down a number of structures and identified them. And they did a lot of geophysical surveys, poor data back in the 70s, but they identified sites. So we benefited from that data, and then we also took what was left and then tried to characterize them for storage. So,
yeah, I might say of the quantifying it, of those 20 dome structures that were identified for us, I believe it's 11 are presently being used for natural gas storage in Iowa right now. Obviously, that made them unavailable to us. And another 3 or 4 are under lease for gas storage. They've never been developed as storage fields, but they also were not available to us. So we just took what was left.
All right. All right. We're going to have to wrap it up. We've got next up Mayor Jerry Sanders from San Diego, who apparently knows a little bit about storage. After that, we're going to hear from Imre Zhuk and the closing remarks from the DOE, and then Matt Lazarevich is going to represent ESA and give us a few closing remarks. And then don't forget, we've got a reception sponsored by Cleantech San Diego and Connect San Diego tonight in the Seaview Room. That's downstairs starting at 5:30. Thank you, everyone.